Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that dives into the depths of the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I'm at the deep end.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm getting far from the shallow now.
So join us in our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. So, Jake, we labour this whole Ghibliotech as a library that we're sequestered in, metaphor quite far. So today we could call ourselves something of a touring Ghibliotech, a touring library.
Yes, it's certainly a lot more spacious than our regular library.
And that's because we're recording live today at the BFI South Bank, NFT3, for Podstock. Mm. And what are we doing today, as usual?
It's just the standard show. A lot of people have paid some of their good hard cash to just see you and me talk about films. That's the special event.
I think we've got to that stage now, haven't
yeah.
we? No, actually, we do have a special guest today. We're going to talk about a film that is very unique in the Studio Ghibli canon, one that is produced by Studio Ghibli or co-produced and made almost entirely outside of Japan.
Yes. This is a really interesting film and there's so much to get into, but I think we're not really the people to give it the best context.
No, who better to give context than the director of The Red Turtle himself, Michael Dudok-DeWitt. And please welcome him to the stage, Michael. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Providing insights and context that Jake and I couldn't possibly match. So what we like to do here is we like to talk about context, production background, and then get to grips with the film itself. I think to begin with, something that defines this podcast for me and Jake is just as much the experience of animation and seeing these films as much as the films and the craft itself. I'd love to know, as a viewer of these films, as a creator of these films, what was your route into animation?
My route into animation. I went to art college. I'm from the Netherlands. I went to art college and did comic strips on the side. And then I realized if you have this narrative of comic strips and you have the music, wouldn't that be absolutely amazing? So, and then I saw my first animation festival in Annecy in France in 75. And I saw just films. I watched all the films and they bowled me over and then it was clear.
Mm. What were these films that were inspiring you and exciting you as a creator, or the comic strips that were exciting?
Comic strip, there was a birth of a whole new wave of comic strips. I grew up with the very safe comic strips for young people. Mm. And then, you know, the Tintins, and so on, the Franco-Belgian comic strips. And then suddenly new subjects became, it's part of, you know, part of the 60s and early 70s, new subjects like mysticism, sex, politics, violence, suddenly became available in comics. Mm-hmm. That was very exciting. Okay. So there was a magazine called Heavy Metal in the States. Mm-hmm. It was Metal Hurlant in France that was like, oh my God, especially Moebius. Yeah. And then the first festival I went to in Annecy, I saw Eastern European films. One filmmaker in particular, Yuri Norstein.
Right. Russian filmmaker.
From Moscow, and they were very poetic, they were dark, some of them were very dark. His were very poetic, very symbolic. Mm-hmm. And that was new. You know, I grew up with Disney and Hanna-Barbera. Mm-hmm. And to see that was like, I'm home. This is it.
Yes, because the 1970s, some would say not the golden age of mainstream feature-length television animation, but it sounds like shorts are where the experimentation, the innovation was.
Yes.
Yes. So is that what made you go into short filmmaking? Because that's where you started.
Yes.
Out of college.
Yes.
We do have a slide here with Tom Sweep,
oh, yeah.
Monk and the Fish, and Father and Daughter, which are three films you made over the course of a decade. Very labour-intensive decade, I'm sure, for what amounts to no more than half an hour of screen time, I imagine. No,
much less than half an hour, yes. Yeah. I was lucky because it was also the golden age of commercial animation, especially in here in London. So I moved to London for that. I didn't see it as compromise because a lot of TV commercials in those days were very artistic and were not pushing the product too much. They were quite discreet on the product and quite strong on the artistic side of the film. Mm-hmm. And that appealed to me, and the fact that I could survive financially from making animation. And there was a huge freelance network, people meeting all the time in different studios. Mm-hmm. So it was very fertile. Start of my career, in a way. A lot of experience, a lot of learning how to be professional and so on. And often they were very, very well paid also. Mm-hmm. So that does help. So I could totally live from that.
Uh-huh. And was it a case of working on the ads during the day and then at night just scribble down a few frames of Tom Sweep?
Not that literally, but on the side I had my personal projects. They were comics, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So at this time, I suppose 1970s less so, but once you get into the mid-80s, that's when Studio Ghibli is founded. Were they, as filmmakers, on your radar at that time, or was it much later that you became aware of them?
Later, early 90s. Uh-huh. I think it was Laputa, Castle in the Sky, that I saw first, again in Annecy Animation Festival uh-huh. in France. And I asked an animator friend, I told him that was that Japanese film that really stood out. And he said, "Well, Studio Ghibli," and I'd never heard of it of them. And often they're called Ghibli in France, but they themselves say Ghibli. And I'd never heard of the studio, so then suddenly something woke up.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the pronunciation of the name
Ghibli
there, which is something we've discussed many times. And actually, with an audience here, I'd like to just have a show of hands. Who says Ghibli? Who says Ghibli?
Okay, I would like it on record that a director of one of the films has just confirmed a J sound.
Exactly.
So if we can all change over to that, that'd be great.
Yes, actually it's an Italian word and the Italians
would say Ghibli.
Ghibli.
Yeah. This is the confusion of translations between languages. Yeah. Well, let's not get into that too far.
We don't need any more iTunes reviews about it.
As long as we pronounce your surname correctly as well today, Michael. Yes. something that's interesting, you were interviewed for Sight and Sound when Red Turtle came out by your son, Alex. And in the introduction, he said that his introduction to these films was to Studio Ghibli was growing up with you, seeing them almost dodgy DVDs from Chinatown, which is how I first. the only way to get Princess Mononoke back then in the 90s when that first came out was did having a child and introducing a child to these films also give you a different angle on Studio Ghibli or animation films in general?
Maybe, yes. You change when you have children. Yeah, mm-hmm. Maybe. I've never seen myself as an animator or animation director too focused on children.
Okay.
And the Red Turtle that we made together is definitely child compatible, but it's not a children's film. It's not a family film typically either. It's more all ages.
Yeah. I love that term, child compatible. I've never heard that before. I think I'll use that. So let's just skip forward to Father and Daughter, which was finished in 2000. It won the Best Animated Short Oscar that year. What impact does that have on a career in the animation community, in the shorts community? And it's the film that I hear that Ghibli saw and started this long conversation.
Okay, there's several angles on Oscars. Of course, it's the most famous prize in the industry, in the world. So to be nominated and to win is like by far the best advertisement for your film, by far. That's clear. I would say to have a grand prize again at the Annecy Animation Festival mm-hmm. is harder to get. There are more films in competition. So within the industry, it's seen as more prestigious, mm-hmm. And some other festivals too. But you have when you make a short film, you have to try to get it nominated mm-hmm. because it's fantastic. I only realized once I got there. I never watched the Oscar ceremony on television, but I remember the day it was nominated. I was working on a commercial for the States, and we were sitting in the edit suite, and an American was sitting there, and he overheard my conversation. Someone phoned me, a friend phoned me, said, you're shortlisted. And he exploded. He said, you must go there. And I said, okay, you know, a bit like typically European or typically British, I said, I'll take it as it comes and it will be great and so on. Once you are there, it's crazy. It's crazy. Mm. It's their religion. It's right. much more than an award. Uh-huh. And they do it well and it's huge and... I mean, just to participate. Mm-hmm. It's very, on one level, it's a party. Mm-hmm. The moment the ceremony is over and people start standing up and you look around and you see all these celebrities a bit tired and makeup has suffered a bit and so, because it's very long, you think, oh, it's good to see people are real people yeah. Because it's very glitzy and glamorous. Mm-hmm. What did it do for my short film? When I made a short film which was nominated, which didn't win. The next film won the Oscar. The moment you hear your name and name of your film, you just walk to the stage because you mustn't trip. I mean, you're in a trance. You must do it correctly. It's very strange. You're so hyped up, so mm-hmm. hyped up. And I did a speech, and I talked to the microphone like this, and looked at the audience, and that's bizarre when you have famous film stars looking you in the eyes, the Clint Eastwoods and yeah. Juliette Binoche, and so on, looking you in the eyes. That's strange. Then there was a press, lots of photos for the press with Ben Stiller. I didn't know who he was, but so
he presented that year.
That year in 2000. And I mean, he was very charming. And then walking alone back in behind stage to make my way back to my seat, I suddenly realized, oh my God, this is it. Practically, it doesn't make so much difference. Mm-hmm. But I've met regularly people who think that making short films is cute. But when are you going to make a real film, like a feature film? Uh-huh. And then when they find out that you travel all over the world, that you get some awards, that your film is seen a lot, then they start thinking twice. They think, actually, you've got a really nice profession. I noticed the difference in attitudes of some people.
Mm-hmm. So was this always an ambition of yours to make a feature-length film? Or you say that short films yeah. are an art in its own right.
It was not, but I you know, I played a bit with the script, which was on the door. It wasn't strong enough. Uh-huh. So when Studio Ghibli contacted me, it was their initiative. Uh-huh. When they contacted me saying, we like your short films, we like in particular Father and Daughter, uh-huh. They made the biggest compliment you can imagine. They said, we think it's very Japanese.
Okay.
And I can see why they say that. And they said, have you ever thought of making a feature film? We would like to produce it. And we would co-produce it with our distributors in France, mm-hmm. Wild Bunch. It would be a French-Japanese co-production. And you would direct it in Europe mm-hmm. with European artists. And I asked them, do you mean you have a story or you want... They said, no, you write story, you set the style, and we'll take it step by step. It may not work, but we just see if it works. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a big ambition to make a feature because you have to, especially in the States, you have to compromise so much. Mm. Their feature films are producers' films, where the producer is the ultimate responsible for the film, and they can sack the director and get another one in, and that's fine. That works, and that makes the film also very commercially very strong. The Studio Ghibli is very much a director's film studio. Mm-hmm. When it's clear who is the director, the director has the final say. Whatever the others say, whether they like it, even when Miyazaki likes it or not, mm-hmm. it's the director's responsibility to make a beautiful film. Yeah. And that, of course, is totally my that's where I feel at home. Mm-hmm. So they confirmed that, and they said it would be on a French law because American law is don't go there, English law is don't go there either. Japanese law definitely don't go there.
Okay.
And the French law in the film industry respects auteur films.
Right.
So the film, by the way, was made in France mostly and in Belgium.
Right. To go back to that first initial conversation, who were you speaking to there? Was that Toshio Suzuki?
Was that
Setagata? Because when you talk about, yes, it's a studio founded by two filmmakers, but then you have Toshio Suzuki, who is the man in the background, who seems to be the one that almost whips the others into making films over 20 years when they'd rather almost retire or whatever. So please, can you contextualise that?
Suzuki is a character. Yeah. He's the youngest of the three. Yeah. They needed him, of course. You can't be two directors and just run a studio and make films. Mm-hmm. You need a producer. He introduced himself to them. He worked for, I think it was a newspaper before, but he kind of gradually worked himself, made himself close to them before they create Studio Ghibli, and then he has the talent of finding what is right at this moment for this particular market, for this particular filmmaker. So he would advise, for instance, typically he would advise Miyazaki, maybe it's not the right time to treat this subject, but you wanted to make another subject, why don't you concentrate on that, things like that. And they trust him.
Yeah.
He did the same with me. He was the one who initially thought of working with a non-Japanese director, with me. And he convinced Takahata to be part of the game because he felt that Takahata would be a better spokesperson of Studio Ghibli for me to work with. Mm-hmm. And he is a director, Takahata, and a producer, of course, but a director, whereas Suzuki is looks more at the business side. But he has very good intuition too, Suzuki, very, very good. And he can draw very well, and he has designed many of the titles in calligraphy on the posters and on the DVDs. So together, Suzuki and Takahata approached me, and Takahata was just going to be, you know, how can you say it, like a mentor for me, just overseeing that everything is fine. But as soon as we had our first meeting, I asked him for more feedback than he expected. Mm-hmm. And he literally asked me, so you want our feedback? He was very, very discreet, very polite. And I said, yes, I need your feedback. Partly, of course, because I have far more experience. But Takahata has a personal, very rich culture and a very fine sensitivity. So I was very curious about his opinion. And also the Japanese sensitivity. It was never going to be a Japanese film or a European film, just a film. But Japanese sensitivity, especially from their classical art, resonates with me big time. So I was curious about that too.
Yeah.
Well, that was the compliment that they paid you, that it feels Japanese.
Yes.
What is that to you?
Okay, the emotion of father and daughter. Uh-huh. So now I'm just talking specifically about father and daughter. The emotion of longing, that they recognize that really, really strongly in their culture. It's universal, it's human, but they have a word for it. It's strong for them, that contained longing, not going all over the place, but a very pure contained longing for a daughter, for a father. The simple graphic style, very, very simplified, very, very, very simple. Takahata especially loved that. And he tries to do the same thing in his way, of course, in several of his films.
Mm. So it's such a wild concept. You know, it's an amazing idea for Suzuki to have to produce a non-Japanese film. But for you as the filmmaker that's brought into the room, so to speak, Studio Ghibli, as a name in front of a film, has so many associations for people around the world. When you're making a film, developing a screenplay, left to your own devices, did you feel any pressure to throw in a witch or anything like that? You know, things that they would expect,
or a little Totoro on the side.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not pressure, but I mean, whoever the producer would have been, I felt that if I make a feature film, it has to be not a good animated feature film, but it has to be an excellent animated feature film. My personal ambition was very high. I expected they would be their standard would be very high, and somehow it's not literally that I felt I had to prove myself to them, but I felt both our levels were very, very high. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at one point, the style of our animation, which is quite realistic, not very cartoony, quite realistic, mm-hmm. and quite detailed, there I was incredibly ambitious, because it's a difficult style for animators in general. There are always exceptions, but animators in general love slightly more cartoony animation. For me, it's a difficult style too. I would struggle with that style. But I felt it was the best for the film, mm-hmm. Simply the feeling of it and the visuals of it. So, and we found the good animators. But Takata said, "You're too ambitious. You won't get that level of, because we sent him a test scene, uh-huh. which was beautiful, of a guy swimming underwater and spearing a fish. And he said, "It's very nice, but you can't make a film in that style. It's too difficult." And then once the film was finished, he said, "Well done."
So you showed him.
The team, yes. Yeah.
I find it interesting. These three shorts look so different to the way that the Red Turtle looks. And if anything, the clear line style and the realism of the characters is almost more Franco-Belgian. And when you said that you read Tintin growing up, it's almost similar to that style.
Yes.
And so what made you go in that direction? Because there's something so cartoony or figurative about Tom Sweep, etc.
Yes, in a way, you decide almost without reasoning. You go by feeling, what feels right. But of course, I ask myself the same question. Why would I choose a style which is difficult to animate? Mm-hmm. And, or let's put it this way, if it's weakly and it's not very well animated, it shows a very lot. It's very risky, it's very vulnerable style. I'd done some commercials in that style, and they immensely. I was incredibly happy with the realistic feeling of the body. I'm deeply influenced by Tintin and some similar artists from Belgium, including Moebius from France. And also, I realized afterwards, I grew up my primary school. I had little books of short stories from different authors, Dutch authors, and some translated from America. And they were illustrated in a style, a very realistic style. These were books from the 1930s, from my previous generation. So they were exquisite. I've bought them secondhand much later. The drawings in there were just amazing. The closest to that is Prince Valiant comic strips from a long time ago, and Winsor McCay, that kind of style. So I've always loved that style, so I think it pushed me in that direction, first unconsciously, and then when I remembered those books, I thought, oh yeah, of course, that's what pushes me.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And what's your role as a director or animator in this film? Because you're obviously, you can't be animating every cell of it. You're having to delegate and hand that responsibility over. There's definitely an element of trust there in who you're working with and what that process is.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't animate anything, so the level of trust was my biggest worry. How good will the team be, and what will be the alchemy between my collaborators and I? Will we understand each other? Because you can talk for days about how to do things better, but at some point, like in music, you just have to feel from each other what you want to achieve. It's very intuitive. How intuitive we will be as a team. So in the beginning, I was incredibly sensitive. We chose the artists very slowly. They just presented themselves one by one as freelance artists from Western Europe, and they send their portfolio, and then they do a test. And then the best ones, you write to them saying, we really, really like what you do. We keep on our list. And as soon as we start, we hope you are still available because we want you. And that way we recruited, very slowly we recruited the animators. A small team, because production period was long enough to allow for a small team. And in the beginning, we had to feel our way in. I had to see what are their strong points, where are the weaknesses of each person. And in the same time, they tried to feel what my vision was. I had a lot of preparatory drawings, a lot, I mean thousands. But that's not animation, that's just storyboard and the animatic, which says a lot but not enough. So for the first two or three months, we had to kind of dance together, and then the first good scenes came in. The first animators who started doing the really good scenes. And I remember saying to my assistant, look at that, that's fabulous. And then things started crystallizing. Mm. So yeah, there was a lot of trust. They trusted me because I was experienced, and by chance also the oldest. And I had a Ghibli aura around me, mm-hmm. because I'd spoken with for years and years I'd spoken with Studio Ghibli on the story and on the storyboard. So they knew that anything they saw in the preparation was already digested, thoroughly digested by me and my producers.
So what was that process over the years developing this story then, and the feedback, the back and forth?
Yeah, that was difficult because it's a very simple story, as you know, Castaway on a Desert Island, that can only go a few directions. You can't go in endless new directions with that, especially the ending. Mm. Is he leaving or is he staying? Yeah, yeah. And I didn't want to fall back on the Robinson Crusoe story at all, certainly not Blue Lagoon or Swiss Family Robinson, mm. certainly not. I mean, I tried to watch all the Desert Island films that I could find, uh-huh. including Castaway. Castaway is pretty good, yeah. and including quite a nice one by Buñuel. I didn't know he had made one. And my biggest problem was not so much telling someone alone on an island and how does he survive. That went actually very quickly. But his relationship with first a woman and then as a family and the ending, it's fragile, it's subtle. If it works, it's like poetry. If it works well, then it's strong. But if it doesn't work perfectly, then it immediately becomes very weak. Mm-hmm. You can't hide behind action or behind suspense. Mm-hmm. Let's put this way, the parts of the story where everybody's happy, where there's very peaceful moments, those are the most vulnerable. Because my fear was, of course, I don't want to lose the spectator. Mm-hmm. I want to keep the spectator totally in the story, which is easy in a short film, because anyone who watches a short film will forgive you if the short film rambles a bit and it's not very strong, because it's only a few minutes. People have that attention. People are too impatient if the film has very, very, very weak moments. Mm-hmm. They zap to something else, or they leave the cinema, or whatever. And I knew that, we all know that. So my biggest worry was, it's a very quiet film at times, very simple, very poetic, but I have to totally engage each member of the audience.
And you don't even have dialogue as another thing to fall back on. Was there ever a version of this film that could have had dialogue? Or was it always, like your previous films, free of dialogue?
To make a short film free of dialogue is not at all adventurous. Many people do. It works. Yeah. Because verbal language is only one of the languages, yeah. and a very good one, and of course used beautifully in endless films. But not a must. It's not essential to have verbal language. Mm-hmm. I've done dialogue in commercials, and to make a feature film in without dialogue, it was not my plan. Mm-hmm. Originally, I had some dialogue. I really believed we needed some dialogue to have a stronger empathy with the characters, but also simply to explain what they feel. At one point, the son tells his parents that he wants to leave. Yeah. Just to say that line already, I thought it doesn't have to be a long conversation, just to say something in that style is essential for the story. Or when a man and a woman first meet, I would talk if I would be in his position. I would simply try to find out who the hell is she? Does she understand me? And so on. And there was some dialogue at that moment too.
I think that that moment where the son tells him that he's going to leave, there's some really interesting work there with the way that the bodies move and even the small, the non-verbal sounds, the sighs or the gestures or whatever, that make that show that this is such a global language. And I think that's maybe rooted in the production of it as well, that you are having to be such an international co-production and you're ultimately telling a story that everyone is able to understand.
Yeah, well, to be honest, the fact that a dialogue-free film is easier to distribute was never a consideration. Once we chose to make a dialogue-free, one producer said, smiling, "Oh, we'll make it simpler for the translation." But if it was important to have some dialogue in there, we would have kept it. Mm-hmm. That was not a consideration. And as I said, I thought the dialogue was essential, but it just didn't feel right for that story. Yeah. So we dropped it.
It's not completely free of voice. There are a few heys in there.
Yes.
Do they dub that in different languages?
No.
The Japanese version where they have their own hey?
I wouldn't know what the Japanese would say, but I see what you mean. And what you don't notice, unless you really concentrate on it, is that you hear their breathing quite a lot. Mm-hmm. That was the sound engineer's choice. Christine, she said, it will increase the empathy with the character when you hear them breathing, even when you don't have to. And we tried that. We asked the actors to breathe in all the scenes where they appear. And indeed, it's subtle at times, but it makes a difference. I think, that's a typical example of how we manipulate the spectator unconsciously. Mm-hmm. They won't come out of cinema saying, "I really like the sound of breathing in that film." Mm-hmm. They will just feel in a subtle way closer to the characters.
Mm-hmm. But you say it's a simple or a delicate film. One change between the last run of episodes we recorded and this new run of episodes recording is I've become a father in that time. And now my experience of this film is so different because even though it starts as a castaway story, it becomes a story that encompasses the whole of human emotion and experience, from love, birth, growing up, death, to leaving home, finding your tribe and all these things. Mm-hmm. It feels, even though being dialogue-free, being some animation and so on are ways of distancing, it's such a powerful emotional and sounds almost personal film. Is that the way you describe it yourself? Are you a personal filmmaker?
Yes, I think that's nice. Thank you. I was a father of two very young children when I did Father and Daughter, which is about parents' relationship. And although I didn't say to myself, "Oh, let's do a film about parents' relationship," it must have made an impact on me. Mm-hmm. I believe I've become a different person since the birth of my children, two children, not just on a hormonal level, but emotional, on a subtle level, the priorities in life. And it's just also, we've all seen those photo albums where you see on the first pages the baby photos and last pages the last photos of when the person was still alive. Yeah. And it always has always impressed me deeply to see a whole lifetime within a short time or within one book. Mm-hmm. I find it very moving. The ephemeral quality of our lives. We get born, we are rebellious, we make love, we suffer, we look back on our lives, and then we're gone again, mm-hmm. completely gone. Our bodies, of course. Mm-hmm. And that I find always very moving.
Yeah. It's one thing we've spoken about with some of the other films in the Studio Ghibli library, that Miyazaki and Takahata have voices in their films. They have points to make, but they're often didactic, or they're analysing, or they're political, or they're talking to a generation below them, or whatever. Which is, we've talked about some similarities between your films, but that's one difference here. If you're you're using the film to work out your own emotional relationship with the world, I'd love to know, in your collaborative production relationship with Ghibli and Takahata in particular, what were the conversations you were having the film was being made?
Yes, of
was
course.
You responding to these levels?
Yes, and you asked me earlier, sorry, I forgot. We had lots of conversations during the development of the story, which took a bit more than 4 years. I started in early 1997. And, I mean, writing my synopsis was early 1997. And I would go to Tokyo on a regular basis. Occasionally, I would meet a representative, Steve Alpert, who was international sales, who was my kind of my in-between producer, because he speaks both languages, so it's easy. And he would sometimes come to London, and we would talk then. I just listened to their feedback a lot, and sometimes it was not appropriate. I struggled with some parts of the story. As I said earlier, they're vulnerable. And there, what you do then is you try this, and it doesn't work. You try that, it doesn't work. You try that, you try different things. And their feedback was very useful. They would say, "We don't get it. Why did you do that?" And that immediately rings my alarm bells. I think, okay, that if they don't get it, then I should really look at that. That's not working. They were... Takahata always ended conversations, "Yeah, but you are the director, you decide," because that's their attitude to directors. But he had very strong opinions at times, and some of them were excellent, and I immediately heard them and immediately integrated them. Others less. I mean, to give you an example, the woman in the story is very natural. She's from nature. She's not from a particular culture. She's just at ease in her body. She's relaxed. She is wise. She belongs to nature. That makes her quite mysterious also, because she doesn't say anything. As you know, she comes from a place, an unexpected place. So the mystery of the woman is a positive quality. But if you push that too far, she becomes too mysterious, and that's disturbing. Then you don't connect with her somehow. That Takahata pointed out very clearly. And I remember he said, you know, people think that in Japan men are stronger than women, but I think women are stronger than men. And the translator, who's a woman, Mikiko, she translated for me, and she added, "And I agree." So he gave some very particular tips for how about this and how about that to make her more present, at the same time emphasizing the beauty of her mystery.
Yeah,
that's just one example.
Yeah, and he always, reading about him, his interests were in French literature and animation as well, and he had a very European outlook. Was that your impression of him as well?
Yes. He loved talking about his cultural knowledge, which was, as you say, vast, very Japanese, very, very profound cultural knowledge of Japan, including the Zen Buddhist philosophy, which I love personally too, but also very knowledgeable about France and the world in general. Personally, he was very discreet. Although we spent lots of very nice moments together, he didn't talk about himself or his family. You don't get invited at a Japanese home. That's maybe you do, but not in our industry. It's quite uncommon. And he didn't ask too many personal questions about on me. But the fact, as you mentioned earlier, the fact that the film is coming from a very personal place, that's the only way I could make the film. He recognized that in my short film, and I think he celebrated that. He recognized that.
Yeah. I think one before we open up to the audience, I think one question, Jake and I are both, we were incorporated into the look of the podcast, we're fans of the iconography of Studio Ghibli, and the very first thing you see in the Red Turtle is the Studio Ghibli logo in red, as opposed to the traditional blue. Yeah. How did you do that? Was there a contract involved? Were there legal teams?
I don't remember who got the idea. I think they did.
Oh, really?
They asked me to design the red color. And I chose one, not too intensely red, in the style of the film. And I changed the layout a bit of the actual drawing. And their reply was, don't touch the layout of them.
Okay, color's fine.
Yeah, the color's fine. It's a lovely red.
Yes, exactly.
Do we have any questions from the audience for Michael about the film, about Studio Ghibli, or any comments on the movie? Oh, we have
one down here.
One here in the corner, got a microphone just coming your way.
Thank you very much for coming in and kind of sharing your opinions. Wanted to understand, you were talking just then about how the turtle is a kind of woman from nature and that sort of thing. Wanted to get a sense for, because I think Princess Kaguya, which Takahata did, the woman in that comes from like a similar place, and whether you had kind of shared your opinions on those two, and what, you know, I think they probably came out at about the same time, almost, whether they informed each other the development of those two characters or so.
Yeah. Takahata started on Kaguya after I'd already written, or while I was still writing the story of the Red Turtle, but it was more or less complete storyboard. So when I heard he was doing Princess Kaguya, I was surprised because I didn't notice that it's an ancient story from Japan. I quickly read the story, and it's very much starting with the bamboo forest. And I asked Takahata, do you think there will be any conflict between making two films where a bamboo forest has quite an important place? And he said, no, it will be stylistically so different, and the place in the story too. He didn't feel any problem with that. Then he never talked about Kaguya. I didn't ask him any questions because at that point we started really working full production on the Red Turtle, and we had very little contact then. He basically said, okay, the story is good, we are happy with everything, now make the film, we are here if you need us, but we won't ask the latest updates on a regular basis. And that was natural. We felt that it was natural. So I was working my film, he was working on his film. When I saw the finished film, I thought, okay, yes, two lovers are flying in the air, okay. Mm-hmm. But then it's not his idea, it's not my idea, it's an archetypal idea, and I don't think our films are so close that people will say, they've used the same idea twice. very quickly on that note, while I was nearly finishing the story, the big earthquake happened in Japan, and a huge tsunami, as you may remember, which was very, very dramatic because we saw all the footage on YouTube and on the news. And at that point, of course, the story of the Red Turtle had a tsunami. So I asked the Studio Ghibli, okay, the tsunami is really sensitive. I want to keep it in because it belongs in the story. But what do you say? Should we change it? Because you can't just casually show a tsunami when a real one just happened. And they said we had a serious talk about that too. When the film will come out, it will be years after the event happened. We think it's okay, it's appropriate. And besides, the tsunami in the Red Turtle is treated with respect. It's not a funny event. It's really, really serious, and they felt that was appropriate too.
Yeah, Michael, you mentioned earlier. You mentioned that the Red Turtle was released in Japan on the same day as Your Name, which is another film that has sort of Fukushima imagery as well. And that makes me think: how was this film received internationally in Japan? The fact that it's almost a European international co-production, but with Ghibli on the front.
Yeah. Before the film was finished, Suzuki told me, Japanese like Japanese films. basically, he said, he warned me that it's not obvious that the film will do well, even if it has a Studio Ghibli logo on it and it comes with a Studio Ghibli aura, because they have plenty of their own films which are excellent. Mm. And we were a bit disappointed with the distribution of The Red Turtle. The distribution was good. I mean, lots of cinemas, but the number of spectators was lower than they expected. I gasped. I thought it was high, but for Japan, it's low. I'm sorry, I don't remember the numbers, but they were disappointed. Mm. The press, I mean, it was very embarrassing. The press was so positive, the articles. Studio Ghibli looked at the articles with surprise. He said, that's really nice. In other countries, it varies a lot from country to country. In France, I'm very pleased with the number of spectators. It is an art house. I don't see it as an art house movie, not as a Pixar movie. But in that context, it was really, really seen by many people. And right now, it's in the circuit of education. In other words, school kids, as part of their curriculum, will see the film. Well, which means hundreds of thousands of new spectators. Mm-hmm. That's in France because they're good at celebrating French culture.
They really are. They yes. are, aren't they?
And over here, it came out on the same weekend as My Life as a Courgette, which is another lovely
and
animation
too,
going
yes.
in at a under 80 minutes.
Exactly.
Well.
So you can yeah. watch both in the space of time of a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Any other questions for anyone in the room? For Michael? Yeah, we're down in the
corner. So we've got two on the front row here. We'll come to you both.
Hi, thank you for answering these questions. A two-part question, really. Do you think you'll be working with Studio Ghibli again in the future? And do you think that your involvement with them as a studio, as a foreign director, is a new stage in Studio Ghibli's history? Do you think that they are going to be making sort of movies with foreign directors?
Thank you. I don't think I'll make another film with them, but we've never had confirmation on that. We never talked about it, actually. Suzuki, my producer, he's getting old. He wants to retire. He's still, almost against his will for a moment, still producing a new feature with Miyazaki, Hayao Miyazaki, but also Gorō Miyazaki. Takahata, as you probably know, has died very recently. And so I don't think there's another another. I don't think we'll make another film together. They had a press release. I was there in Japan, and a member of the audience asked, "Is this setting a precedent? Will you work more with non-Japanese directors?" And Suzuki replied, "They wanted to work with me on the strength of my previous work, which they liked a lot." The fact that I was not Japanese was secondary, so they didn't have a strategy of choosing a non-Japanese director. And so, in other words, he kept it quite open, but he looks at the talent more than the nationality.
But do you have another film lined up, another short, a feature, The Red Turtle 2, even redder?
Yes, always clear that it would never have a sequel. if someone else wants to make a sequel, that's his problem or her problem. I don't have another feature in mind because I'm very choosy with the story. I get lots of stories sent to me, books or scripts, and they're fine, they're professional, and they probably could be very strong films with someone else. This film, it took me 9 years to make, and not just a nice, casual profession. It's like grindingly tiring. Many, many months I would work between 80 and 100 hours a week. And it's not just casual work drawing. It's like all the time solving problems. I would love to make another feature, but I don't have a story.
Okay.
I've got a story for a short, mm-hmm. Which is very strong, so that may come first.
We'll keep our eyes open for that. I think there was one final question here on the front row.
Why did you choose like a turtle out of all of the like other animals you could have chosen?
Thank you. Yeah, you know what? In the beginning, I didn't even realize there would be a turtle in the story. I knew he would be one man alone on an island, a tropical island. It would not be home for him. He wants to go home. He doesn't want to stay. So that was very clear, and something would stop him from leaving. Just standing there saying, I can't leave, I thought was not very exciting. So he would make a raft and make a raft again and make a raft again, but every time he would be stopped. That was very clear. I also really, really wanted to have a love interest. I wanted him to meet a woman and develop that in a very natural way, not too much flirting, not too much arguing and so on, but very natural man and woman coming together. But I didn't know the answer to what stops him from leaving the island and where does the woman come from. I had ideas, but they were not strong enough. So what typically happens with story writers and animators, you let it simmer in your mind. You just let it turn somehow, and sometimes consciously you think about it, you think, how about doing this or that? No, maybe not. And sometimes it just happens without you realizing. I call it incubation period. And then suddenly you get, oh my God, how about this? You get a really nice idea. I call it, it comes from your unconscious. And then you look at it and you say, wow, this is good. You get very excited. Then you wait a day or a week or even a month to see if it survives. Because sometimes you get very exciting ideas, but the next day you think, oh, it's a bit naff. Mm-hmm. And then one more, I literally remember I live in London and I've got a small garden. I was walking in the garden and suddenly the idea of the turtle came up. I'd already gone through dolphin, whale, octopus, the whole list, shark. And they're all fine, but they would have given the story a totally different angle.
So many sequel ideas
the
now.
Red shark.
Yes. How about two dolphins or two sharks? Or two
oh, there we go. Yeah.
But there's something about the turtle. It has a carapace. And the fact that the carapace then is part of the woman, this is a spoiler for those who listen, that's really, really interesting idea. What's striking about, people love turtles because they're solitary animals. They're not violent. They are marine creatures, but they can be on land. They have a head and arms and legs. They breathe. At the same time, they're not cute. They have got a beak. They're hard. They have got slightly angry expression or irritated expression. And that I liked, the fact that you keep your respectful distance from them.
Right, I think that might have to be it.
Thank you so much for your questions. And thank you so much for being here at Podstock for this very special episode of Gibliotech. Yeah. And thank you. Please join me in thanking Michael Ludogovitz.
Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.